This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you. Shopify is a global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage, to the first real life store stage, all the way to the, hey Marge, did we just hit a million orders stage? Shopify is there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. And sell more with less thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. Running a growing business means getting the insights you need wherever you are. With Shopify's single dashboard, you can manage orders, shipping, and payments from anywhere. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the United States, and Shopify is the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/ifanboy, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/ifanboy now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/ifanboy. This is iFanboy Pick of the Week 751, brought to you by iFanboy listeners just like you who are washing their hands, wearing their masks, and being good citizens.
You say the price of my love is not a price that you're willing to pay. You cry in your tea, which you hurl in the sea when you see me go by. Why so sad? Remember we made an arrangement when you went away.
Hello, welcome to iFanboy Pick of the Week, episode 751. I am Connor Kilpatrick. This is Josh Lanigan.
Hello.
And it's a short one this week.
It is?
It's a regular-sized one.
Okay, yeah. I was like, it's short? How do we know that now?
I'm still tired from last week.
Okay.
We are iFanboy. And every week we read a bunch of comics. One of us picks one they like the best. We call it the Pick of the Week. Although that's been a challenge as of late.
Sure has. Like. And I'm wondering, is it me or is it them? And I don't know.
We'll talk about that book, other books from the week, the patron pick, listener mail if we have time. We'll have fun. Spoiler warning, this is a review show. There'll be spoilers. Exercise caution. Use the show notes. This week, Josh, you had the pick.
I did, and it was the pick of the week is Fantastic Four number 24. But that was not reached without some soul searching. I feel like we do this a lot now, but I enjoyed the books I read. I did. I think it was a lot of solid 3¾ stars. Mm-hmm. I think that's where it was, but there was not much in terms of a standout, and there wasn't, and the ones that were better were kind of better in the same way that we've already talked about. So there wasn't a lot of extra to it. So I entered into consultation with my partner here, mm-hmm. Which is something that rarely happens.
True.
And it was not like, tell me what to do. I was like, what are you thinking? Because the idea is, you guys have listened to the show, and when we talk to each other, sometimes something will occur that hadn't, and that will sort of change the way you're thinking. And so it came down to between Marvel's X and Fantastic Four. And I went with Fantastic Four because it was kind of delightful, and it was an aside from all the stuff that was happening. It was just like, let's go back and expand on this one little moment that happened in Fantastic Four 50-something years ago.
Right.
And so it was sort of an old-timey story. And I had wondered coming back to this book after the Empire stuff, I was like, "Well, please don't let this be," and really as a move. And let's remember, Dan Slott, was half of Empire. Coming back into this and just being like, "Well, let's do this kind of story, this sort of like throwback of the time that Iceman was with the Fantastic Four while Johnny Storm was off having a temper tantrum," and. It was equal parts modern and throwbacky. It was it's just that, and Dan Slott's very good at that because he's a person who's very familiar with the old comics. He grew up with them, and he understands them and appreciates them and likes them, and is pretty good at bringing them into modern comics, I think, which is a real skill. I think, you know, Kurt Busiek is another guy who does that really well in a different flavor, but
he rides the line very, very well.
Yeah, and it doesn't always work, I was really not into the Spider-Man stuff he did, but Fantastic Four lends itself more to that than Spider-Man, I think. Fantastic Four, in its essence, is 60s goofy. There's almost no way to get around it, and I think that, I also think that when this book gets too serious, it loses something. It doesn't work, which.
Yeah, this is the tone I really like in the Fantastic Four. First of all, it's a great Nick Bradshaw cover. He's been doing the covers, but this one is really particularly very good. And I like you, when I saw, first of all, it was a little confusing because there's a giant banner across the top because the second half of this issue, I didn't even read it.
And I was like, oh no.
A tie into Fortnite. I didn't. A Fortnite licensing deal, that's fine. That's what they do. But.
Hey, they got top numbers on it, top names on it. You know,
confusion about if even this whole issue was like a thing or if it was, but that was just the second half of the issue, which was double sized.
So we're not talking about that.
No, I didn't even read it. I won't read anything Greg Land does. But once I saw it was like a one shot throwback story, I was like, oh, that's interesting. And then it was delightful. And the Paco Medina art, you know, did a good job of sort of replicating 60s style, if not, you know, not trying to do 60s style. You know, I feel like the characters were thicker. You know, Reed had this big jaw. They used some technique to try to replicate the dot pitch coloring, which didn't necessarily work, but at least lent itself to making it feel different.
Yeah, and you know, like, there was the design of the time. So, like, that Iceman was what Iceman used to look like, you know, back then.
The snow guy. With the boots. It's just so strange he's wearing boots and not, like, underwear.
Well, here's the deal. Not a lot of traction with ice.
That's true. Friction boots. So, I mean, everyone, you know, is wearing 60s clothing and 60s. Sue has the 60s bob haircut. And, you know, you've got those unbeatable Fantastic Four costumes and the old X-Men costumes, which are terrific. And it was just a lot of fun. And this is a reset issue after Empire. You know, those two kids, the Skrull kid and the Kree kid, are living with them. They're officially been adopted by Ben and Alicia, and they're going to have a big dinner to celebrate, and then that's when things go awry. They call Franklin back, who's been hanging out in Krakoa, getting his ears pierced, doing this rebellious
thing. I have a comment about that. I'll get to it later.
And so Iceman brings him back, and the Fantastic Four scanner at the door says, enter members of the Fantastic Four, and Iceman goes, oh, I guess I'm still considered a member. And that's when you have the Johnny Storm freak out, and then the flashback to when he had quit and Bobby temporarily for one day became a member of the Fantastic Four. I thought it was a really fun story. I liked the flashback, you know, Bobby being ostracized and then, you know, sort of leaving his group in a similar way to Johnny, but out of pain instead of what, you know, tantrum. And then being accepted by the Fantastic Four family for one day, and then it all got righted. Plus, you had some sweet aim with the giant tank situations in New York, and then sort of a greatest hits flashback of villains that they fought. I just thought this was really well drawn, tons of fun. I really enjoyed reading it a lot. When I finished reading, I was like, oh, that was just delightful.
It really was well drawn, and also the coloring from Jesus Aberto, I thought, was perfect.
Yeah, great.
It was perfect. Again, you're striding the line a little bit. For most of the flashbacky stuff, it was almost one tone, but just slightly modernized. And it was, the package is really nice, I mean this in the best way, it was out of place. Like the way that Johnny Storm acted was much more like he acted in the 60s. It was like this character's had no development at all, which isn't really true. Yeah. Oh, I get it. That's a metaphor. You know, and I like just the very fact that Sue was mad about him getting an earring. That is so not a thing now. You know, like, first of all, he can create worlds.
Right.
Second of all, like, he puts on his little jacket over his tights, and you know, he has an old timey X-Men unit. He's wearing like Cyclops' old uniform for some reason.
Well, that's the standard X-Men uniform. Like, if you don't have your own uniform, that's what the sort of the background X-Men wear.
And like, but he's got like a 90s short jacket on with a hood, and he had the earring, and his mom was really upset about the earring, and I was like, yeah, have you seen kids today? You know, but the fact is the whole thing was a little, you know, superhero Norman Rockwell. And I think that was really fun. And just, you know, just flipping through those flashback pages, you know, Paco Medina put on a little clinic here, I think.
Yeah. First page where the flashback on page 7 mm-hmm. of the digital reader, the bottom panel, they just like, you know, Reed's got the square jaw and there's the bot. Like, it's all, it just looks very classic. And there's, you know.
Willie Lumpkin.
And I just love those old outfits. Like, it just looks really terrific. And look at the little expression on Ben's face in that panel.
Yeah, it was a really, like, and I think one of the reasons that it was harder to choose is that it stood out, but in a very subtle way. Like, it just, it was not a thing I was looking for. So it took a little bit, but it really was, it was delightful. And it was a nice, like, this is the same guy who wrote a lot of that story that you and I had a lot of problems with. You know, a week ago. I mean, he didn't write it a week ago, but I like that. I like that there's a nice wherewithal to know how to adjust and do a different thing. Or even just having the inclination, like, I'll do something different today. And I like that.
Yeah, and for now, this really works. I don't know going forward how much these kids are going to get annoying, you know, but...
Yeah, there's a big, we've said this, there's a big Damien thing going on here, which could get...
And now there's two of them.
There are two of them.
So, and I don't know what they're planning on doing with this girl with the wings. You know, I really was hoping they would sort of get over that, but she's still here. And isn't Bobby a brunette? At the end here, when Bobby stays for dinner, you got two blonde dudes.
I don't know that he is, but I don't think he used to be. You know what I mean?
It's not a big deal, but I thought he's a brunette now.
It's funny because they didn't take any. And they didn't like mention the fact that Bobby's changed considerably in his depiction since then. So there's nothing about him being gay in here, and that's not necessarily bad, because there wasn't really a spot for it. But it does make it interesting when you play the old story back against the modern interpretation, and he's feeling ostracized from the group and like he doesn't fit in and doesn't know why, and it's not really named, and that's kind of interesting if you want to apply that to it. I don't know if it's intentional or just how I'm reading into it, but it's an interesting layer.
Well, it's there. I think it's there if you want it to be. I mean, I think
that's what
you
know,
the surface level thing is that he was much younger and the butt of the jokes, so that he doesn't fit in because he's significantly younger than the rest of the X-Men.
I don't think I knew
but
that.
You can, yeah, he's like 13 or something. He's like Robin compared to the rest of the, you know, the rest of them are in their 20s. And so they treated him like a kid. And the whole thing was he was training in the danger room with the safeties on, and they were making fun of him. And even Jean laughed at him. So, but you can also take it as he just generally feels out of place because he's of his sexuality, which he's not aware of yet. Mm-hmm. So it all works, I think.
Yeah.
This is a great comic. And I think if you're not a Fantastic Four reader, this is a great issue you can just check out. And I think you can really enjoy it.
If you're a Fantastic Four reader who's lapsed, comic. You've been like, it hasn't been into me lately. But if you're looking for like a Fantastic Four, you know.
It's a one-shot. It's not. It ends. It's a complete story. It's a Marvel comic. Mm-hmm. It just feels like a Marvel comic. I know we say that sometimes. It's sort of an undefinable quality sometimes.
Mm-hmm. No, you're right.
This week we had a shootout at the patron pick, which we're going to talk about in a minute. And this book was the second place book by one vote after leading for most of the voting period. So I figure we should talk about it.
Yeah, Department of Truth number one, written by James Tynion IV, art by Martin Simmons, letters by Aditya Bidikar, who I saw his or her name a few times this week, and I thought, oh, there's a new letterer in town.
There's a couple of new letters in town this week.
Yeah, I've been seeing the names pop up a lot more recently, which is interesting.
This is from Image Comics. This is the newest release from Image.
So I probably would have skipped this, but I knew it was like in the running for the patron pick, and so I just sort of read it preventively. And the reason that I would have skipped it is, and I'm gonna. I've yet to be very impressed by James Tynion. I don't think he's a bad writer, but he's not been a writer who's done almost anything that spoke to me for very long. And And so I don't get excited about it. However, mm-hmm. he's got some heat on him. He's mm-hmm. definitely moved up in the DC organization. He's put out several creator-owned books over several publishers. So I recognize that there's probably something there that I'm not seeing. So I start to read it, and right away I'm kind of struck, and not necessarily in a good way, by the art.
That's, to me, the big story here.
Well, we've got what reminds me, you know what I was like? I was like, this looks like a Joe Casey book. And like, there was a while in the 2000s where this was the kind of book that was coming out. I'm trying to think, not Mike Hawthorne. Who was the guy who did the truck driver book with him? Huddle? Mike Huddleston?
Mike Huddleston?
Yeah. A little like that, little Ben Temple Smith, little of that action. On the good side, like, the beginning is extremely abstract. And as you keep going, it sort of settles into itself a little more. So you have this story where...
Continue, then we'll go back to the art, because that's really what I really want to talk about. But go ahead.
You know what? Let's talk about the art, and then, because I have
so,
other...
here's my problem. Okay. This kind of super abstract, not even abstract, just super stylized and hard to follow is... It reminded me a lot of Dave McKean on Arkham Asylum.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that really works because the characters are iconic, so you know you're looking at Batman, you know you're looking at Joker, but when you're talking about a story full of just regular people... I don't think this is a good idea. It was really hard to know who was who or what was going on. I mean, there was obviously the blonde guy, the main character, but, you know, a lot of old dudes in the mm-hmm. story. And it's like, is this the same old dude as before? And then at one point, and we're going to get to the story in just a second, the characters are on a private plane and they're flying somewhere and... one of the main scary guys says, "Hey, look out the window," and the main character does, and we're all supposed to be shocked. And I don't know what the fuck I was looking at.
Yep.
It was this 2-page spread of the plane flying, and we find out later it's a giant ice wall like Game of Thrones, but you know, it's very abstract. There's an overlay of a globe of like a flat map on it. There's the Earth, there's the moon, and I kept looking at it going, "I don't know what I'm supposed to be looking at here." I think if you're having a big reveal like that,
you're 100%
right.
Moment
in the story, I was like, are they flying into an abyss? Is like, what is this? And then the next page is like, you know, is that an ice wall? And I was like, well, I guess it is.
See,
but the art didn't tell me.
I thought that was supposed to be the flat end of the world.
Right. Because you don't know. You just like, what the fuck?
And I thought, well, it doesn't look like that.
Yeah.
So no, you're absolutely right. That was a big reveal and it did not play at all. Now, I will say on the other
side. It looked nice.
Yes. I will say on the other side of that, like, the art.
Simmons is very, very talented artist.
Yes.
It just didn't work as a storytelling device, medium or whatever.
I think that maybe this wasn't the type of story that this best goes with, or at least the structure of this particular story, because it's literally about mystery. So you could look at it and say, well, this art is mysterious, but it was missing a clarity. It is very indicative. I think Dave McKean's a very good example, or it felt a lot like. Fell in places mm-hmm. to me. There's certainly pages where it really looks like it's produced that way. So that being said, it was an odd choice. At first, I thought it was going to be, because the very first page is basically smeared. Again, not bad, but I was worried. I was like, this is going to be hard to follow.
Yeah, I was the cold open is Lee Harvey Oswald's interrogation, and some of the dialogue is straight from the newsreels. Mm-hmm. Which I know because I watch JFK every week for like a year and a half in college, or not a year and a half, a semester and a half.
He's not kidding.
We had a Thursday JFK day in my apartment.
It's fine. I was like,
oh, this is going to be really rough to follow, especially at 12 panels a page for the whole issue. But it did become more clear.
It leveled out, and so at the beginning, I thought, well, I'm going to do my best to give this a fair shot because. I like this. This is interesting. This is something I know about. And as we kept going, I thought it got better because it was subtle enough. However, there was a point for me where it became too on the nose. It all of a sudden, it was like, oh, we're going to talk about all the issues of the day. And we're going to talk about conspiracy theories and right-wing alt-right internet and flat earthers and the rich and the oligarchy and
Koch brothers.
Yeah, and I think that there's a place for that. I always have a very hard time with art exploring these kinds of historical occurrences at the time that they're happening, because I feel like it felt very much like a really intelligent take that came completely off Twitter.
Well, yeah, that's like every
I know
creator now. It's hard to not have context in the world. You need some remove. I didn't dislike this. I
didn't either. I really liked it a lot more than I thought I would. Yes.
But I did enjoy it. The art was a real problem, and that's sort of, foundational to a comic. Mm-hmm. And the twist was, I couldn't decide if I liked it or I groaned at it.
It was, yeah, you're right, but it was interesting.
It's not a twist,
and
it's a reveal.
It was unexpected. And
we haven't told people the story in case they've heard it. So basically the high level is, it opens with the Lee Harvey Oswald interrogation. These two shadowy government guys come in, clear the cops out, and they have a very oblique conversation where they're not saying what they really want to be saying because they'd be giving us too much information. But clearly Lee Harvey Oswald is involved with something to do with this assassination. Cut to the present day, where this sort of bookish FBI agent who is an instructor, he's not a field agent, is brought in to be questioned by some shadowy government organization because he just had this strange experience. The conversation is happening in the basement of the Library of Congress. He thinks they're going to kill him. And he recounts the story of he helps track right-wing groups on the internet. And he went to a flat earth conference because a lot of things were happening around that conference. And he ends up sort of falling into this conspiracy of flat earthers run by stand-ins for the Koch brothers, who clearly have a bigger agenda. And then at the end, something is revealed to him, which I'm not going to say because...
Yeah, no, that makes sense. And the problem, I'm going to go with the problem, is like I said, it starts, as we keep going, it starts to get more and more on the nose. Like, it's constant. Let me finish this sentence before you write me a letter. It's constantly pointed out that these are white men and they're all the same and like this. And that is a real thing, that is a source of problem or whatever, but like, I know it. And it just feels like armchair, t-shirt slogan, social commentary, if that makes sense. Like, or if you're going to do that, you better be funny about it. In fact, there's bits here where he had at the Flat Earth Convention, they're all dressed the same.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, that's kind of funny. Maybe you're going to have a little satire or humor thing here. But if it was that, it didn't play. It's not Mark Russell.
I thought that they let him into the circle way too quickly.
Mm-hmm.
Like,
yeah,
they find out he's an FBI agent. Instead of being really suspicious about what he's doing there, they're like, oh, great, we got one of you on our side.
Mm-hmm.
I was like, you guys aren't even going to vet him? Like, you're going to bring him into the ballroom with the movie playing and the really rich, powerful guys watching it and the lady with the red dress and just like that?
But, yeah, I mean, like, if I'm comparing this to Billionaire Island, there's a clear win. Like, they're both saying the same thing, more or less. About culture, about society. It was just. I think it's a lot of good ideas here, and there's probably too much.
Well, that's sort of the usual knock on Tinian, is there's too much. But I liked it enough that I'll probably read another issue.
Me too, and I know that. There's criticism, but a lot of it is me coming to terms with trying to understand what I'm doing and what I'm reading and seeing if maybe I'm wrong about some of these presuppositions. But it's not bad work. It's interesting. It's thoughtful.
Just, for me, it becomes an issue of when does the really interesting and well-made collage work collide with storytelling?
Yeah,
and at the end of the day, you need to tell a story with the art, as interesting as it looks. And if there's a lot of more problems like we had in this issue, that might be the thing that keeps me from reading more of it. He can put together an art piece really well, but if I can't tell what's happening, and it doesn't do its job because it's a story, first and foremost.
I think that's hardest in the first issue, though. I mean, like, it should get easier from here, and so that's your real challenge. At least you can tell the main character is.
Yeah, luckily. But I just was really stuck on that one double page spread, which was supposed to be a big moment in the book. And just if you can't communicate what that means, then that's a failure in storytelling.
I think it needed, like, I know that's not my, I agree with that problem. It's not my biggest problem. I think my biggest problem is that I think it needed about one or two more passes to really shore up what it is and what it's doing and what the tone is and trying to keep it consistent, because it I don't have a good sense of what it is. It's clever doesn't do it for me. It's not enough. You know, like there's good ideas, but the delivery method needs to be refined. And, you know, I definitely have a problem with on the nose social commentary. Like, yeah, it's very,
well, you said it correctly. It's Twitter commentary. Yeah.
And that's not deep enough. I don't have it, but you know, like that exists for that. When I come to art, I want deeper. I want the next level of thinking from that. And I think either that, or I want it to be funny as shit. One of those two things.
Injustice Year Zero, number 7, Tom Taylor. Kyan? Tormey?
I mean, if it was Keen? Irish, it would be Keen. Keen?
But I don't
Keen.
Know
I bet it's Keen. Keen Tormey. That's my guess.
Keen Tormey. Rain Barreto, Wes Abbott. This is part 7 of the digital first prequel to the Injustice series that we didn't read.
I haven't read half of it.
Oh, I haven't. Well, once we decided we weren't doing it for the Bookspot, at least anytime soon, I haven't started reading it yet.
It's really so good.
This is the slow build up to all of our favorite characters being massacred.
I know, but escape that.
No, but this was a great issue.
It was so good. Issue. It was, you know, we're going to keep going back and flogging this horse, but man, Tom Taylor writes these characters in such an interesting way. And even like, there's this bit where Amazing Man is attacked, and the way that he escapes it by touching a doorknob and turning himself into what, brass or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that was really wonderfully done as a comic book sequence. You know,
this is the aftermath of the Joker getting that mystical artifact that allows him to take over people's bodies. In the last issue, he used it to take over Alan Scott and to stab and kill. Which one did he kill? Not Dr. Midnight, because he's
wasn't it? No,
wasn't it? No.
I don't know. Don't worry. Wesley Dodd, Sandman.
Yeah, Sandman. He kills Sandman, and then he falls out of the sky because the Joker doesn't realize that there's a limit to how long the ring can stay charged. But now he's in the hospital. His husband, I guess, mm-hmm. I don't know, his partner, husband, boyfriend is there, and I love the scene between him and Superman. That was a terrific, terrific scene.
The characterization part of that, where he walks in and the guy's like, I already answered all of Batman's questions. He's like, I'm not here for that. And he just talks to him. It's like, oh, this is the top Superman. And then Superman walks out of the room and Batman's like, what did you learn? He's like, I didn't go in there for that. And then something else, like, he's like, what'd you think? He's not lying. Like, so he did go in for that. He meant it. It was real, but he still took something out of it that was useful that he could give to Batman. I thought that was a really delicate, nice balance. Also, I dug, after the assassination fails and we get back to the, I don't know, this thing going on with the Joker is really interesting, and I'm liking the way that it's being portrayed.
Mm-hmm.
Like, there's a page, you know, it's 18 on your digital reader there. He's sitting back in the chair and he's like, why isn't this as much fun? And he's still the Joker, but he's got this whole other thing going on. You know, I thought it was really subtly interesting. And then, you know, we once again have to make Harley Quinn into a hero, because that's what always happens. And
although I did like the moment, it was reminiscent of, you know, the shocking bit in Mad Love where he backhands her, you know, mm-hmm. way back in the 90s when it was before, you know, Joker treating her like a rag doll was a normal thing, where he makes some decision and has her jump off the top of this giant staircase. And that one panel where she's in the air, you know, in this beautiful sort of swan dive, because he's got this mind control power, is shocking, because she's about to fall very far.
Mm-hmm.
Not to her death, but certainly to her injury, and the beauty of her jump compared to what he's making her do—the horribleness of that was sort of shocking.
Yeah, and then the cut to the page of her like in the bed, it's sad. It's really sad. And now that being said, I'm so tired of these characters. So for me to be able to talk about it in that
way, it's funny because you've been saying that, and I get it, but I don't agree. But then this week,
mm-hmm.
I looked, like, I had all of my books downloaded, and when you have, I use my list view to read my books, and where it shows you all of the books you've just downloaded. Mm-hmm. And I had 3 Batman books in a row, and all 3 had Joker on the cover. And I was like, well, okay, I get it.
It's like, a lot.
I understand what Josh is saying. And it was like this and three Jokers. And then there was the Joker Warzone book all together. And I was like, okay, that's a lot of Joker on the cover. Like, they were all his face in close up.
Mm-hmm.
I was like, okay, that's a lot. But I just, it would be great if
the, it doesn't even count Batman, which is the Joker War. And the.
Right.
It's just.
It would be nice if for once Harley didn't turn and join the heroes. Mm-hmm. Like, it's just for once. I realize she's really popular and, you know, she's got a cartoon.
But you've got that story. Let this be a different story. Or just leave her out of it then, if you have. I mean, right. They're not going to do that.
Well, we're going to talk about more Joker in a minute, but let's talk about Marvel's X number 5 from Alex Ross, Jim Kruger, Welby, and Corey Pettit. And I struggle to say why I love this, but I do. And I'm really glad you made me read it. And much like Fantastic Four, this feels very classic Marvel. I mean, it does include the one page where Welby does a really convincing Jack Kirby. But it's strange because it's not a new story. It's not breaking any ground. You know, it's a well-trod area, but I think partially it's because all the characters are wearing their classic 80s Marvel costumes, but it just feels like a warm blanket, especially this issue where all the heroes basically show up.
And there's like almost no action. They're literally all in a room talking.
They're all hanging out in the Baxter Building, and it's just one hero after another that gets the little spotlight with this kid. You know, Daredevil and Spider-Man and then Falcon and Beast and classic Beast from the 80s. And, you know, just everything was fun. And then, I love the back matterness because you get to see Alex Ross's sketches and he does these incredible sketches. But the sketches, for me, spoiled something. It spoiled who the guy in the hat is.
Oh, did it?
Yeah.
Because of the name?
Well, I just didn't look too closely at the guy at the hat, the mysterious guy who is wearing fedora and sort of leading the villains. And in the back, there's a sketch of him. He's called the Demon.
Oh, I see him.
But he's very clear who that person is in the sketch.
I didn't notice that. You just spoiled it, even though
happens in the show.
That's fine.
I just thought that was funny that they were spoiled that one that way. But anyway, that's not important. And what's important is, like, as a Marvel fan, I can't believe you wouldn't enjoy this book because this is just like as a Marvel. Fan of a certain age would really feel
it's
like
about the heroism of these characters as people. Yeah. I think actually there's a really
in the face of nothing. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean that's another thing. That's sort of a strength that is happening over in what's the
this is like Deceased.
Yes, Deceased. Is that the stakes are there, and so you know you've taken away the safety net of everything, and that gives it a certain weight that it wouldn't before. But there's a really nice scene.
Other than Earth X being, you know, coming next, you know, whoever's in Earth X is not going to die, but I don't remember that.
Yeah, I don't remember very well. So, but I'm just taking it on its own. There's a scene where Spider-Man has sort of like, he gathered himself up because he's more like in this, he's more messed up than the dude was in Into the Spider-Verse. He's having a hard time. And he's sort of pulled himself together thanks to talking and working with the little kid. And he sees Iceman and Angel. In these great costumes, and I loved the notes on the costumes in the back, by the way. And they're delivering groceries to people, you know, via ice slides, you know, and they're not doing it. They're like, they keep calling it their own business, but they're not taking money for it. They're just out there doing good because since everybody has superpowers, then they don't need to do any superheroing. So, you know, this is the thing that they can do to help people. It's the people who can't go out. You know, because they look a certain. There's one shot like of the people getting their groceries in one of the windows, and you know, they're these weird mutant looking folks, but they're really happy and they're saying thank you, and like it's just like a little sweet nod to the heroism of the people and what form that takes. I think
right. They don't need to be punching supervillains to be who they are. It's helping people, and if people can't go outside because of all the superhero violence, then they can't get groceries, and I might as well send them down the ice chute.
Yep. Yeah. It was fun. It's been a nice little story that is unexpected. Welby, I find it difficult to say because I don't know what I'm saying. Really perfect for this. There's this little interlude with Luke Cage and Nighthawk, and it just ends with the two of them like doing the manly arm clasp handshake.
I kept waiting for Nighthawk to be bad just because that's what you'd expect.
You're trained.
And then but it wasn't. It was just like he wants to help. And it's just this felt like I was, you know, but besides the fact that Welby's a very modern artist and is a terrific artist, but it felt like I was reading a comic in 1985 again. Like,
yeah.
It just was great. Everyone was really great. Fun. I really like the scene with the kid who's black and Falcon, who wanted to talk to Falcon. And that was, you know, it was great. The kid just loves Captain America, and so they have a nice chat about that.
Yep,
it was good. It was good. Yep. This was. I think I would have picked Fantastic Four, but this would have been something I would have thought long and hard about.
Those are the two that I think were in the final contention at the end.
Yeah.
But again, like, you know, the strengths of both of those things, I don't think are immediately apparent. Like, it's given me a feeling. Why is it? What is it about this thing that does that? And that's why I like these discussions.
Quick break time. Let's talk about how you can help support this show. We thank everyone who does so. Patreon.com/iFanboy is the main way you can do that. You can go there, support us directly. You get all kinds of perks. You help unlock stretch goals, which leads to more content for everybody, including media splodes and talk splodes and book splodes. The next stretch goal we have is the G.I. Joe Corner show. We did the G.I. Joe Corner segment during the time when there was new comics. People really liked it. They wanted to keep going. We can do that. If we hit our next stretch goal at patreon.com/iFanboy. And then right after that, on the heels of that stretch goal, is the quarterly barbecue video show. So if you want to see either of those things, or you just want to help keep the show going, help support the show, and get your nice perks, patreon.com/iFanboy. iFanboy.threadless.com is where you can buy t-shirts or masks or phone covers or bath mats, other things, hoodies, notebooks. Anything in our 8 designs we've got going there.
Is there anything sexy? Can you get anything sexy with iFanboy?
You know, I haven't really delved into that.
I guess anything is sexy if you need it to be.
Depending on who you are and what you're doing with it. Mm-hmm. iFanboy logo, Herm, pick a
sexy
podcast,
phone covers.
Ratings, if one of the Electro GDAT, Nothing Makes Sense, Nothing Matters, and Stay Home and Read Comics. All those designs are available there. And we continue to give a portion of our profits on Stay Home and Read Comics to the Comic Book United Fund. So thanks for picking up those items. iFanboy.com/support. That's where you can help us out directly via PayPal. Again, if you are a Luxembourgian banker and need to put your cash somewhere, iFanboy.com/support. Then iFanboy.com/Amazon. You can buy all the books we talk about via the Booksplode show, and I just updated that page. So it's current. So you can buy all the Booksplode books there, as well as a general Amazon shopping link. And we thank everyone who does all those things to help support the show. You do keep us going. I just sunk a bunch of money into an upgrade for my equipment. So that comes from the various support we get. So thank you for doing that.
He's also been undergoing a massive technological mystery campaign exploration at home to try to figure out how to make something work. So don't ever think that he doesn't care about you. that's what I know. We can't get into it now, Connor. It's
banging my head against the wall.
Connor, what hurts? This hurts. That's what it is. John Constantine, Hellblazer number 10. I'm just going to tell you right now, I think there's two more of these. You're probably going to have to hear about it. So,
that's fine.
Suck it.
I'm not excited to talk.
I'm not you. I'm just the listeners were like, this again?
The royal
Here's why is I thought this was gone forever from my life, and it returned, and it returned in beautiful fashion, and it's about to be gone forever in my life again. So.
Yeah,
and I genuinely
back,
think that
how it happened, what the reasoning was, it's all a mystery. You had this weird 1 year gift handed to you, and we can eulogize it when it finally ends. I'm really curious what you thought of this issue, because this issue, it seems to me, as someone who didn't read the last series, was very much was that the bar from the final issue of the series? Like, is that all tying in?
I'm not sure. That was long enough ago that I don't really remember. So I really have been going more on the tone and if the characters feel right and the stuff that's happening sort of fits in with my idea of it. This wasn't pick of the week because I'm not entirely sure what to make of it, but I know that there were a lot of things that I did like. Largely, I was really happy to see that old John and new John are now together and talking, because while I don't want it to end, we need to get moving with this.
Well, you were skeptical of this old John, new John. So what did you think now that they finally met and
I'm not sure. I'm not sure where they're both coming from. Like, I get the idea of old John wants new John's soul, and I liked the logic of why it has to happen the way it did in the explanation. It's very it's a dream sequence for the most part, but and so it's not entirely clear what's real and what's not, and there's a lot of double talk and sort of intrigue around stuff. So part of it is that I'm not sure what to make of this yet, but there is a bit where Basically, all of the friends that we have met over the course of this story, that the new relationships that John has made in classic Constantine style, you know, they're all, well, they're not really ended, but they're,
you know, they're like, brutally murdered, right, in a Godfather-esque sort of montage. The, you know, the Scottish bouncer, the mute, the hippie alchemist mage guy, and then another one.
Mm-hmm.
And it's revealed to not have actually happened. But I was like, oh.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So, like, you got that feeling. You got the same way that John had the feeling reading it, was you did too. And I wasn't...
Because these 10 issues, we've really...
Yeah.
Spurrier's done a terrific job of making them interesting and funny and feel real and...
Which is what Ennis did. That was the thing that he did best. And it's the same. And you, if you've read any Constantine, you know that people who get close to John, people who you like, people who he likes, do not fare well. And so, but the trick of it is to kind of make you forget that that's going to happen. Then when it does, you go, oh, right, this always happens. so you got a little reprieve from that. And that was very Constantine. That was very, you know, how it was supposed to be. And like when it happened, I was like, oh, I can't be mad. That's what happens. But it was a little more complicated than that. So like I said, I think the next two issues are going to help clarify what happened here to me, mm-hmm, a little bit better. But it was great. Like it's spot on target. And again, no idea how this even got published in the first place. No.
I would love to find out why.
Yeah, I mean, like, I would like to think it would be the purity of, like, this was a great pitch and the first script that came in was amazing. Like,
right,
you know, that should be enough, but it's not.
Well, there's no other media tie-in. You know, it's not like his TV show still on. He's, mm-hmm, a character on Legends, but he's, you know, it's not like they would. I would have a hard
and
time.
I can't.
None of those other characters have books. So, like, it's just interesting.
And I can't imagine this is selling even close to what Hellblazer was when it was canceled originally at 300.
Yeah.
I don't know. That's speculation completely. Oh, it's Joker time.
Second Black Label book in a row. Batman, Three Jokers, Jeff Johns, Jason Fabok, Brad Anderson. I just wanted to mention this continues to be the best Batman book being published. However, there was a moment here where they had Barbara and Jason Todd kiss, and I was like, no. but luckily Barbara's like, yeah, that should not have happened. They were just both very upset and, you know, dealing with the Joker stuff, and it was like a moment of weakness, which is fine. It makes it interesting, but I was really worried they were going to make this into a thing. Now obviously it's Black Label, it's out of continuity, but still I was just like, nope. And for the second week in a row, no, I don't remember when that Batman the Continuing Avengers happened, but here we get Joker beating Jason Todd with the crowbar again, and it was pretty brutal again. But that's to be expected in a Black Label comic, not in a animated series book.
Very quickly, I wanted, mm-hmm, to mention Superman Man of Tomorrow number 16. This is the digital series.
Mm-hmm.
I noticed on the cover that the name of the writer is Kenny Porter, and I thought Kenny Porter was a listener of the show for a long time. I'm not sure if he still is. And it was, I was just really sort of proud to see somebody from the sort of old school I fanboy.
Did you confirm it was him?
Yeah. I wrote to him and I just said congrats, mm-hmm, and I checked in and it was a fun little Superman Dark Side, you know, outthinking Dark Side little sort of those digital first stories are sort of basic one and done shots.
Mm-hmm.
It was, you know, a little fun Superman story, perfectly entertaining and, you know, very much about, like, this is who Superman is and that problem solving. It's not reinventing the wheel. Scott Collins' art, you know, a great little story. And it's just always really great to see extended members of the family start to do good and make it out there. He's done other comics before that, but, you know, Superman, so.
Batman, the Joker War Zone, number one. This is just a one-shot. And this sort of ties together with everything we've been talking about. More Joker, more James Tinney in the fourth. And I wasn't going to read this, but I saw the creator team. It's an anthology featuring five stories, two by James Tinney in the fourth, but one by John Ridley,
mm-hmm,
who is the Oscar-winning screenwriter who's doing that Batman miniseries coming up. One by Joshua Williamson. One by Sam Johns, and I don't know who that is. So this was actually really strong. I love these. You don't love them as much, but I love these short story anthologies. This is taking place to the side of the Joker War, and I'm not enjoying that, but there was good stuff in here, including the first story, which is Tinian and Guillaume March, in which the Joker, before he breaks out of Arkham, goes to see Bane and yells at him for killing Alfred because it was wasted. You know, he didn't even do it in front of Batman. And it was a really great sequence where he's like, this is the one guy you could have killed that would have hurt him as much as his parents, and you did it in front of Robin. You didn't even make him watch. Like, it was this really great, you know, breakdown of Joker's understanding of Batman's psyche. And, like, you could have been the greatest villain of his life if you had done this properly, but you didn't because you're an idiot. And it was just, it was really good. I was impressed. And then the John Ridley story was good. It was all about the Fox family.
You've got the master of Batman torture standing right in front of you.
Yeah.
And he's telling you.
He's like, you wasted it on a Robin. What the hell's wrong? Like, it was good. It was really good. And
that's
then
grim, but it's good.
John Ridley was a Batwing, Lucius Fox family story, which was good. Olivia Coipel drew it, and it looked terrific. And then the Sam Williams story was a Poison Ivy story. The Josh Williamson story I want to talk about had David LaFuente art, and it was about Spoiler and Cassandra on a mission. Just a fun little mission to take out these dumb villains, and they decide that their original mission is to go find the backup bat signal because their main one's been broken, and they think that people need the symbol in the air, and they end up deciding they need to put the bat symbol on their costumes because the symbol's important. So the last shot is them sort of jumping into the sky. They both have the bat symbol on their costumes now, and it's because Cassie's wearing the old Batgirl outfit.
Oh, I cut that off. The old one or the
the stitched up one, but the black one with the face mask. Yeah, she's not wearing her orphan outfit. She's wearing her
Batgirl outfit. I love that. That was such a good miniseries.
Yeah,
it was a series.
It was a series, yeah. It was very strong. And then the last Tinian story was, what was that one about? The Poison Ivy story, that was all right. Oh, the last Tinian story was drawn by James Stokoe.
Yeah, I was looking at that just now.
And it was really, I mean, the story was fine, but the art was terrific. Really, really good. So it was a fun anthology, even if I don't really care about the main story. It was a nice little character pieces in there. I was really impressed by the Joker story that Tinian wrote. This is a Tinian week.
Well, there you go.
Tinian week.
Good for him.
Those are the books we're going to talk about, but over at patreon.com/ifanboy, the patrons get to vote to add a book to the rundown, any book they want. Like we said at the top of the show, it was a crazy week where the Department of Truth was the leader for the first, 36 hours of voting, and then Shang-Chi very slowly but surely took the lead over and never looked back. Shang-Chi number one, Marvel Comics, written by Gene Luen Yang, art by D.K. Ruin.
Oh, yeah, D.K.
And Philip Tan.
Philip Tan did the flashback bits.
Sebastian Chang and letters by Travis Lanham. Shang-Chi obviously was announced as the next big Marvel movie. And it wouldn't have been out by now. I don't think they'd never shot it. Who knows anymore with all the shooting schedules and coronavirus. But they're obviously banking on Shang-Chi as the next big thing. Gene Luen Liang is the next big thing and has been for a while. So this was an interesting pairing. I know there are a lot of fans of Philip Tan. I was so happy he was not the main artist. I just don't like his work. He just doesn't, I don't respond to it. So when the flashback ended, I was like, oh God, thank you. So this was very much an introduction to Shang-Chi, which is a character I don't really know all that much about. He's the 70s, you know, from the time in culture in America when Kung Fu was big. So he was introduced in Marvel in the 70s as sort of that character. And I'm sure I've seen him in a story. I'm sure it involved Iron Fist, but I don't know anything about him, so this was a nice introduction to him, his world, and the characters in it.
Yeah, I realized that too, is that like he's a character who you see around sometimes, and there's been a couple of half-hearted attempts to bring him back or do a miniseries here and there. But yeah, I don't really know anything about him. I couldn't have told you his backstory. I just know that, you know, he's good at martial arts. That was about the end of what I knew. So I think that as an introduction to this character, and it feels it's a little disappointing in that it, you know, is scheduled in such a way that it was, you know, supposed to be the lead into making this character sort of a big deal, and hopefully there would have been a tie into it, but that's, you know, like you said, that's not going to happen. So it's got to stand on its own. And I don't know exactly. I didn't know what to expect, and I didn't know where it was coming from. So they're starting from ground zero, and it was okay. That's my take on it.
Yeah, I mean, the thing that Gene Luen Yang is the master at his own work, and his big two stuff has been not, I don't want to say just okay, but like I liked New Superman a lot.
Superman smashes the Klan, which is sort of outside of that, was fantastic. Yeah. But
that's probably the best melding of his personal work and corporate work. But like, this was okay, and it was very introductory, so it's really hard to judge. Mm-hmm. The tone was a little bit. You know, he writes YA comics, and
sort of.
Yeah, I mean, for the most part, they're YA books, and this tone was sort of in that realm, but not, but sort of. It's a very introductory book. And the art was okay. I thought the art was solid, but it didn't like blow me away or anything.
Yeah, I'll tell you what I liked. I think as an introduction to the character, I can probably say this is the best Shang-Chi story I've read. So, right. You know, it's not a high bar, but it told me more about this character than I'd known before. There's a bit where we cut to Chinatown after we're in the mysterious League of Kung Fu Assassins or whatever they are, and they have their little battle, and that's fun. And he's working in this little Chinese bakery in mm-hmm. San Francisco. And I thought that part was really interesting because you sort of get to know who he is. And the yep. point is, like, if he's not a hero for hire and he's not out doing stuff, he's got to get a job. So he's going to go work in this bakery. And the old lady there is, you know, the old Chinese grandma or auntie, you know, and she's cute and funny and sassy. And, you know, and he's just a good guy. He's got a whole Clark Kent mm-hmm. vibe going on there.
Yep.
A lady shows up from his past and it's a mysterious sort of conversation. And then as happens in every martial arts book ever. People are in their room or their house, and then a bunch of people break in, and they have to fight them. There's no martial arts books where that doesn't happen.
Smash the window.
Two of them the last couple of weeks. We learn it's a family story. And that's kind of interesting because we get to learn more about the character through that. And I thought the last page, basically it's a half page split, and he's saying, I have to save my little sister, and she's saying, I have to kill my big brother. And I thought, oh, that's kind of interesting. It's it's like the last Assassin's Creed game, but that's neither here nor there.
He's supposed to be the leader of this group by mystical right, but he's not there anymore. So his sister sort of instigates a coup and takes over the group, and so now they're going to come into conflict. And there's a lawyer that thinks he's cute. There's this sexy British. Asian assassin,
and but the original would be Hashishin, so you're almost there.
And there's all kinds of conflict for him, and I enjoyed it.
Yeah,
I didn't love it, but I enjoyed it.
Yeah, it was okay, and I think it is a good entry of the character, so it kind of can go up from here. There's a lot of heavy lifting that has to be done here that isn't necessarily fun. It is fairly similar to the Kirkman book.
It's very similar to Firepower, yeah.
Yeah.
And the problem is Firepower has Somni.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. So this is going to fail. This is not going to fail. Well, this is going to look worse by comparison.
This is going to have a more authentic feel, like this will be more Chinese, basically. Mm-hmm. So, you know, sure. Like some of the characters who are not American will have, there's more to it, you know, than say, Kirkman's interpretation of it. So that's a strength, I think, in that. Although also...
For sure. I'm talking about the art side.
Yeah, no, the art side, it's not even close. But coloring's very good. I like that he's always sort of, he's in red the whole time, so he kind of always stand out red. I think red is the lucky color in Chinese culture. So, you know, like that's there. It's just, one thing that I like is that Chinese culture is very different than our culture. And I think it can be difficult sometimes to interpret what's going on, but I always like the idea that there's something going on under the surface that I don't quite understand and that I will come to learn about as I keep going. It's just like learning about different people in different cultures, even when it's not necessarily upfront in the thing.
Mm-hmm. Plus, Fin Fang Foom was in it.
That's a really good point. And when it, like, just that, seeing that name just makes me happy. I'm like, oh, sweet. You know he has tiny pants, right?
So, yeah, why isn't Iceman wearing pants, but Fin Fang Foom is? Yeah, I mean, this is fine.
Dragon Balls.
It didn't, blow me away, but I enjoyed it enough to read more, and I'm looking forward to reading more, and we'll find out how this goes.
Ratings.
So let's do ratings.
Ratings.
Shang-Chi, number one. 3 out of 5.
3.25.
All right. Sticking with it.
Yeah.
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 So there you go. Patreon.com/iFanboy. That's where you can go. Every patron can vote to add a book to the rundown. But those who give it the $5 or higher level get your own superpower live on the show. But before we get into that, I just want to issue a correction.
Oh.
So the iFanboy Analytics Department keeps a spreadsheet of all of our powers. It's a spreadsheet, database of powers. And Chris, the head of that department, who sends out the report for us to read on last week's show, misinterpreted my power from last week. Now, I don't know if I was drunk and was not properly conveying the power, but I need to ask you a correction. And Chris, this is how we just communicate to Chris, by the way. It's through the show, not through interoffice emails.
That's
or
anything better.
Like that.
That's much better.
The power was not that. All right, let's just use an easy example. If I was the patron and I punched Josh, I don't turn into Biff. Josh turns into Biff. That's the power. He had it the opposite way. In the database, he has me turning into Biff when I punch someone. It's when whoever I punch turns into Biff.
Okay.
That's the patron power. So if you were in a room full of people and I punched all of them, you'd have a room full of Biffs.
Do you want to be surrounded by Biffs?
That's what makes it interesting.
Okay. So you really
got to think.
All different
kinds of Biff. A lot of butt heads.
Make like a tree and get out of here.
You have 50s Biff. You have Old West Biff. You have middle-aged Vegas Biff.
Question.
But then middle-aged rich egg Vegas Biff. Like, all kinds of Biffs.
Is the style of Biff random?
Yeah, it's totally random.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah, yeah. He can't choose which Biff they become.
Okay.
But the point is the punch E gets turned into Biff, not the punch er.
Mm-hmm.
Chris needs to make that connect that correction in the database. Now let's move on.
Yes, let's move on. So Hugo Quilicini, which that's my favorite name I've said in a while.
It might be the best name we've ever said on the show.
Could be Quilicini, could be Quilicina. It doesn't matter. Every way that you could possibly slice it, it's great. But Hugo Quilicini is 100% perfectly photogenic. There are no bad photos of Hugo.
No bad angles.
Nope.
Always squared up to the camera.
It's not like always looks beautiful or perfect in the photos. There's not bad ones. There's none of those half open, like your eyes sort of, or you're looking the other way, the wrong way.
In the middle of talking
or the angle that makes you look like Jabba the Hutt. There's none of that. He's captured in photos optimally every time.
Right.
Yeah. And that's magic. I mean, don't.
Totally.
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. Brandon D. Bell is a vague precog. What that means is he's got a vague feeling about things. Hey, Brandon, is it going to be okay? I think so. Like, maybe. Or, I mean, probably not.
It's almost like he can see the news, but he can't necessarily interpret the news very well.
Right. He's got a vague sense that, yeah, I think things will be okay, but,
You know.
Maybe. Or, not for a while. I don't think. I mean, in a little while. He can't give you any specifics. How long? What's going to happen? It's more like he's got a vague feeling about things.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really all he can do.
All right. Do you want to do this one email, and we'll call it a day?
Sure. Thanks for being a patron of patreon.com/fanboy. We did 100 emails last week, but we'll do one more this week. Chris writes in. This was an email meant for 750, which we'll probably do a bunch on the show going forward.
Yeah.
Chris wrote in and says, 14 years listening and counting. When a musician is at their creative peak. Oh, I know who this is. This is our friend Chris.
Yes.
When a musician is at their creative peak and churning out hits, it's referred to as their imperial age, like George Michael from 1984 to 1990. Two-part question. Who's in their imperial age now? And do you have a favorite imperial age from a creator? So I guess the question is, who's in their imperial age now musically?
No, I think he means...
And then also comic-wise.
I think he means comic-wise.
Oh, okay.
He's applying this, like that applies to musicians. And obviously we are not qualified to make that statement about a current
artist.
Who's
in their imperial age now is a very hard question. We talked about this last week.
I mean, you could easily make a case that Tom Taylor and Donny Cates as writers are in that imperial age, probably.
You're right.
Although, I do think that they both have, I think they're early in it, if that's the case.
That's the hard thing, as you were talking about with the Department of Truth, can you judge an imperial age as it's happening? Or do you have to have remove context from it?
No, but I think you can look and say, well, it's been a heck of a run, and we're working on it. like it could go either way. It's not clear. I'm trying to think of an artist who is in that, but I know there are plenty.
Well, there's plenty of great ones, but as we talked about last week, there's hardly anyone that's like moving the industry or changing the industry.
Yeah, I think that you have to talk about it from a purely creative standpoint, where like this person is churning out great work. So if we looked, doesn't do a lot of work, but there's a certain point where you could have said like Goran Parlov is in his imperial age. Like, it sounds like
Ribic, Chris Somni. Yeah, you know, like there's a lot of people.
Do you think Chris Somni's is over?
No, his art's still incredible. I mean, you're talking about just the creative output. The art's still incredible.
Yeah, I know. But if Art Adams drew a book today, you'd be like, that's great. But you wouldn't say he was in that period. So what I'm wondering is, if you're talking about a six-year period, is that
over? By the way, Art Adams did do a page of Legion this week.
Yeah.
Maybe. I mean, do you have to? Does it have to be combined with sort of hit-making?
Don't know. I'm almost... I think the only way I can go is by artistic merit. So I would,
because he says it's when they're at their creative and they're churning out hits. So that's hard because in comics aren't really hits.
Yeah, no, I'm not going to go. I'm going to go by creative on this just because that's the best way that I have to look at it. And it's funny because I think it's hard to make that judgment about times that you were not around for. So you can easily say, oh, Jack Kirby from 1962 to 1968. But I don't really know. I mean, I kind of know, but I wasn't there. I didn't have that feeling. But I can say... you know, Kurt Busiek from the late 90s to the early 2000s, say 97 to 2003.
Right.
That dude was destroying everything he touched in a good way. I mean, there's so many good comics from that period that he was involved with, from the Institution of Astro City to the Avengers to Thunderbolts. You know, like he was just hit after hit after hit. Avengers Forever, just amazing stuff coming out of that mind.
That would fit the definition because it was creatively and financially successful.
Yeah.
So he was a big deal. I mean, I would, you know, Mark Waid from that era as well, on the other side. They were sort of the two sides of the same coin at the time. I mean, the last real easy one is, again, what we talked about last week, is Bendis from 2000 to 2000 and like 8 or 9.
Yeah.
And Geoff Johns pretty much at that same time. You know, between Action Comics and Justice Society and all the event stuff he did versus Ultimate Spider-Man and New Avengers. And that, even if it was just those two books, but Bendis did a lot more than that, Powers and other things. Everything he did was not only impactful, but really good. So those are the last, I think, two major Imperial Ages.
Darwin.
Yeah, I mean, Darwin's different because he wasn't as prolific, but everything
he did. No, but
if
you go
great.
2004 to... you know, basically up through Parker. I mean,
yeah,
basically
sure.
Like the new frontier through Parker was that. I would also go with, I'm going to just say Ennis and Dillon together as a team from the end of Hellblazer in through the first chunk of Preacher. And not that Preacher got bad or anything, but like sort of those two creative. And actually you could even take it into Punisher. I mean, like that was just an amazing team. You can go like that forever.
I mean, there's the whole Rucka run from the late 90s when he was on Batman and then he was into Queen and Country through the early 2000s. And then similarly, Brubaker. I mean, Brubaker is still doing great work, but he was much more in the mainstream of the industry.
Brubaker's a little like Ennis in that way. Like, he did his sort of really like varied and interesting work in mainstream, and then he's like, that's what I'm going to do now. And the stuff that he's doing now is really good, but it's not like the same... you know what to expect, and if you like that artist, you're going to like their albums. You know what I mean? But it's not...
He settled into a groove where he does his albums.
Yep.
He puts them out.
People who like him buy those.
Makes the next one.
Right. Yeah.
He's not doing the talk show circuit. He's not...
Yes. Yeah, you know, yeah, absolutely.
Performing at arenas. He's just doing his albums.
He's Bob Mould. He's Paul McCartney.
Yeah, he's working at a farmhouse, putting his albums out. And they're great. They're terrific.
I feel like I need to think of more artists who are doing that, but I'm having a hard time remembering them for whatever reason. There's been dozens of them.
Yeah, as we talked about, it's tough.
Tom King is in his.
Yeah,
he might be ebbing. I mean,
we don't know. We just don't know what's going to come next. That's the problem with being in the middle of it.
I'm trying to fit it in a six-year period in my head for some reason, but I don't know why other than he just said.
Yes, because that's the email.
Yes, I know. I'm just... It's invalid. I recognize
contact @ifanboy.com. Great email, Chris. Sorry we couldn't get it on last week's show, but it's on this week's show. So there you go.
You probably got more time and less drunkenness.
book. So we got a lot of stuff coming, has come out and coming out. So we have our previously have we have our Booksplode review of Pluto Volume 1, and we have our Media Splode, in which we talked about many things we were watching, and we also talked about Bill and Ted Face the Music, and we answered some the first. We had our first Media Splode email discussion in that one, which was a good one, I thought. And now coming up, here's what's coming up next week. We have soon we have a Talksplode.
It should be this week.
Do you want to tell who it is?
Yeah.
By next week, I mean this week because we're recording this before it comes out.
Yeah, Gene Luen Yang, writer of Shang-Chi. By the way, I had no idea Shang-Chi was coming out. And I had actually moved the date that I was going to record with until after it came out. And I was like, well, that's perfect timing. But I talked with Gene for quite a while about his career and his work and his latest book, Dragon Hoops, and you know, all the books in between. And almost every time I get off one of these calls, I'm pretty giddy. I'm pretty happy. I'm like, that was so much fun to do, and I hope that goes on to you. But I really felt that way after this one. He's a great guy and an understated genius.
Really.
Actually, no, he's an official genius.
He's an official judge. Don't. Yeah, he's an official genius.
Yeah, no, I don't know why I put it that way.
So that's coming up soon, and then this month, because we fell behind on the last week's Talksplode, should have been last month, so this month you're also getting a Booksplode, and we're going to tell you, we told you before, it's Pulp from Ed Brubaker and Sean Phillips. So it's the Image OGN that just came out, not just, but fairly recently. So if you want to read along at home, Pulp from Image Comics is the next Booksplode. And then also I wanted to mention that, again, September sort of got away from us. We missed our hangout, so we're going to do a special two-hour hangout this month on October 24th at the usual time. We'll post all the information, but October 24th, a special double-sized hangout to make up for the fact we didn't do it in September, and that'll be fun. So
when that happens, you're gonna have to bring your questions, because we will fade out. Actually, that's not necessarily true, but still.
Maybe yes, maybe no. Always be ready just in case.
Listen,
we can't do it all ourselves.
Get over to IFM. We used to do 5 shows a week.
I know. I'm just
Than that. Seven shows a week.
It's hard when Ron. We can't talk about everything because Ron is a job. So we have a limited amount of things we can talk about.
Yeah, he'll do it if you'll give him long enough. Head over to ifinbar.com. You can find all of that stuff, all of our podcasts, all the shows that are there so far, all the content that's ever been done. Just look up Jimsky. Look up Jeff Reed's stuff. Just read through some of that great stuff from the past if you have time. It's better than the news. You can find out what the pick of the week is before the show comes out by liking facebook.com/ifanboy and following @ifanboy on Twitter, @ifanboycomics on Instagram, which will also feature the best of the week in panels. I don't think I cut out a single panel this week. Even though I don't always post them, I always cut out some.
So it's just for you. It's just a special thing just for you.
Yeah, I guess so. Follow us individually, CS Kilpatrick and J.A. Flanagan, both on Instagram. I'm all done with Twitter. That's gone now, so that's not going to be a thing we go back to anymore. Over at our YouTube page, youtube.com/ifanboy, you can keep up to date on the old video show re-uploads, which is a fantastic blast to the past. This week is the 2007 Holiday Gift Guide. You know what? Some of those books might still be appropriate as we approach holidays now.
Oh, maybe, for sure.
Yeah, so like there's definitely some perennial favorites in there. And of course, the 2008 New York Comic Con preview, which I watched. And it's me.
Funny because they're on two different tracks, you know, years apart, so it's confusing. But yeah, the mini's funny because it's you.
I'm standing in front of the Javits Center talking extremely fast with very big hair, and I'm so skinny. I remember that jacket that I was like, oh man, that jacket doesn't even fit around my midsection anymore. It looks huge on me there.
If I recall, you almost get hit by a truck at the end. And yeah, you were like on speed. Like,
yeah, well, what I want to know is, did you have like notes or cue cards of something? Because I was
we talked about it on the walkover, and I think we did two takes of it.
Uh huh. Wow.
And then with the first take, and it was like, okay, that was good. Now you talk about this, and like, but yeah, and then I just mentioned the third show was comic books and music. So it was like comics. It's comics are related to music. Like that was the Friday episode.
Oh, cool.
So music comics, like death metal, black metal. What was that book from Oni?
Yeah, I know, but I don't remember.
Comics and music related together. That's the Friday show. But Monday's the mini Mondays. Mm-hmm. We've got Monday, Wednesday, Fridays when the new shows come out on YouTube. Or the new shows from
old
13
shows.
Years ago. Yeah. But yeah, that was a funny mini. It was funny. It's 2 minutes of Josh just talking as fast as he can and trying not to get killed by a guy just out of the tunnel from Jersey.
Yep.
So if you like the show, please consider writing a review or leaving a star rating on Apple Podcasts or wherever it is you listen to podcasts, whatever aggregator. As we mentioned, we're now on Apple Music, which now has a podcast section. So if you search iFanboy, you'll find it there. And if you use Apple Music and you want to follow us there, that'd be great. But
you mean Amazon?
That's what I meant. Amazon.
Yeah. Because it's Apple Podcasts and then so Amazon Booby Music. Traps.
Amazon Podcasts. That's where we are now. But also any show you listen to, it's a great way to help support any show you enjoy is to leave a review and a star and or a star rating. It helps people find shows. And anytime that happens, people who make the shows do appreciate that. And we all thank you. And even better than that is word of mouth. Tell your friends who are looking for podcasts or comic people or, in the store, the comic store. We used to have stores that would play our show in the background, which I think is funny. So that we thank everyone who helps spread the word, and we do appreciate that. And that's it. This show feels short.
It isn't.
It's not. We're long, actually.
Yeah, until next week, I'm Connor. Not. Do you remember when you could go to movies and you could go see like an old movie? You remember that was a thing? I saw Goonies like a year or two ago, and it was the best.
Oh, it's great.
It was so much fun, and I thought... oh my God! You know what I was about to say? They don't make movies like this anymore, but they don't.
They don't. Those things are now on TV, like Stranger Things, or whatever it's. Or
yeah, but that's just a reference of it. That's a shadow of a thing.
Yeah.
Because it's so weird to me that so much of the stuff that we grew up watching was influenced by what the people liked before. So it's like serials and pirate movies and stuff like that that they would have seen when they were kids, and now. Our kids are growing up with our weird interpretations of those interpretations. Like it's this echoing gene. Anyway,
echo of an echo. It's an old, it's very pulp, serial inspired.
It's over the top. It's very, it's very silly.
It's terrific. Though.
Some uncomfortable, not age well racial stereotypes, but friends.
You're talking about the Italians?
Yes, that's what I meant.
So, all right. Until next week, I'm Connor.
Well, Solomia.
Oh my God. Oh, I just have chills thinking about the blender. Oh,
I get
chills.
And then he says that I made a sound.
This kid's great.
Good night.
Everybody.
This episode is brought to you by BetterHelp. How's your social battery doing right now? I've never used that phrase, but I instantly know what it means, and I think it's interesting because it works two different ways. Some people need to have their social battery charged, and they this is the introvert-extrovert thing, and some people, they've got enough energy for other people, but then it's time to sort of step away, and, as we get to this part where winter is ending, which, again, it's opposite. I love winter. I don't need it to end. You start getting together with more people, and it can be a little draining on top of every other thing that we all have going on in our lives. I just assume everybody's overburdened because I think everybody's overburdened. But it can be tough to deal with. And also, one of the things is, you can't necessarily understand why you feel that way or why it's making you tired, but it's a real thing. If you think that you could use some help with it, if you could figure out a way to make things better, therapy is a great way to help. It can give you that kind of self-awareness to know how to ride that level just right so that you feel good, you feel right. If you're thinking of starting therapy, you can give BetterHelp a try. It is entirely online. It is designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule, which is, again, we've been talking about being busy, right? You got to fit that in. You got a lunch period. You can do it during that time, whichever. That's possible. You fill out a brief questionnaire and get matched with a licensed therapist. You can switch therapists at any time for no additional charge. I like that. There is no penalty for finding the person who is right for you. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/iFanboy today. Get 10% off of your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.com/iFanboy.